The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Board Games Anonymous, the podcast about board gamers and the insane fun we have at the table together. This is Chris.
This is Anthony.
And I'm Jeff.
And this is episode 439, Civilization Games with Jeff Gamble. We'd like to thank all our Patreon backers for helping us bring you a brand new episode. All right, friends, we are back and we are so excited to be here with you this week. We have a special episode. We have our friend Jeff Gamble with us. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how are you guys? Thanks for having me on the show this evening. I really appreciate it. It's been a long time since I've recorded anything, and I'm really honored that you guys were willing to have me on so that I could ramble as the old man of the mountain about Civilization games.
Oh,
someone's got to do it. I love Civ games, but I never feel qualified enough to ramble about them because they don't get played as often. So I'm excited for you to do it so that I can be like, yeah, I like that too.
There you go. Yeah, what he said. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Jeff, you're burying the lead a little bit because you have a long, get it? Long. You'll get the joke in a second. You have a long history with board gaming and podcasting. So why don't you tell everyone about your experiences in the tabletop industry and some stuff professionally as well.
Sure. Thank you. I started a podcast many years ago called The Long View, and was inspired by some great podcasts that were there when I started out. I just kind of decided one day with a couple of friends to just sort of take a run at it. And so we started a podcast, and the sort of thing that we were looking for was a lot of the podcasts that we were listening to were giving you the sort of latest and greatest and what was new and talking about the newest games. And I kind of had a special spot in my heart for what I guess would be considered some of the older games. And in this industry, of course, that's kind of anything that's probably 4 years old or more is considered ancient. And so I kind of thought, okay, what if we had a show that kind of focused on just a single game and really kind of took a deep dive into it? And originally the thought was my friends and I, we would kind of get together and we would play a game at least 10 or 15 times or something like that and then do a podcast episode. But we quickly found out that we wouldn't get a whole lot of content on doing it that way. And so what I decided to do was start inviting people on the show the way you guys just did. And the way you have in the past, you have a guest come on. And so I would try to kind of reach out and say, hey, I'm thinking about doing a episode about such and such game. If there's anyone out there who's really passionate about it, who really has a lot of experience playing that game, we'll set up a time and we'll do a recording and you can tell us why you think this game is so special. And so that kind of became the sort of core of what came to be known as the Long View Podcast. And we did episodes for probably about, I think it was close to 7 years. So you guys have already been on longer than we have. Congratulations, by the way, on the 10 years. It's awesome.
Thank you.
And yeah. It's any kind of milestone like that needs to be celebrated. Because it's a considerable investment, as you guys know, doing something like this. And, you know, you stick with it for that long, it's really something special. So kudos to you guys on that. So, yeah, you did the show for a while, really enjoyed it, and then the pandemic hit. I'm a teacher, and so overnight, everything changed about what we did and how we did it. My wife is a nurse, and she unfortunately was kind of on the front lines of what was going on here in my region of Pennsylvania, which is in the Pocono Mountains. And I just didn't have the mental or emotional sort of energy to deal with anything anymore. So I kind of just, you know, said, you know what, I got to focus on the family. I got to focus on the job. And I kind of said a full goodbye to the podcast. You know, that was a little bit bittersweet, but it was probably, you know, not a terrible thing. There's been a lot of podcasts that have stepped up and kind of do the same sort of thing that the Longview did. So that's kind of the podcasting history. As far as my personal gaming history, I've been gaming since I've had kids. You know, my wife and I, that kind of was like our thing to do. We had moved up to the Poconos after we got married, and we didn't really have any family up here, so we couldn't really ever go anywhere, couldn't do anything. But what we could do was we could order a game. So our first game that we ordered was the Catan card game. And that was our introduction. And then after that, we got into Carcassonne. And, you know, those games just kind of blew our mind. Like, those were the first games that we had played outside of, you know, Clue and Monopoly and Risk and all the things that most of us grew up playing. And so that kind of started our love affair with Euro games and with the board game hobby in general. Had a lot of great memories and time spent doing that together as soon as we get the kids to sleep. and then I started bringing board games into my classroom, which I know is something that's near and dear to your guys' heart. And you've talked about that. And, you know, suddenly I was able to get students who were maybe a little bit reluctant in my fifth grade classroom to really engage in some concepts. So, for example, when I would teach probability in math, I'd bust out Can't Stop, you know, and they would play that. And then we kind of talk about why the board looks the way it does and why does it take so many, you know, successful rolls of 7 to reach the top, but only a few to get to 12 or to 2. Do you think there's a reason for that? And so they were able to kind of use games to sort of intuit some basic principles of probability, right? Or I would use Alhambra to talk about perimeter, you know, building your walls because they love playing Alhambra. And we also talked about probability with Alhambra because right on the board for the players, it tells you the tile distribution. You know? So how many tower tiles are out? How many are there in total? You know, what's the probability that, you know, what's the likelihood that you're going to be able to pull a tower before the next scoring? So really getting them thinking in terms of that nature. And then playing games in language arts like the venerable Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective. We would do that every time we had our mystery unit. And we did The Mummy's Curse, which anybody who's played that game, you know, knows that kind of real fun. It's something that's engaging to the students. And they were in teams and competing to see who would be able to crack the case first. And you know, the reading and the journaling and, you know, kind of writing down their thoughts about what they would learn from different clue points. And so all of these are ways to kind of motivate students and sort of teach curricular sort of ideas and points and concepts on the fly, which I found to be something that was really valuable when working with students. And so that's something that I had a lot of success with. You know, at one point I even brought in Washington's War. And when we were studying the American Revolution and we kind of did what ifs, you know, what would you have done if you had been Washington at Long Island? You know, would you have attacked? Would you have retreated? Why was he always retreating? Why did he never stand and fight? And so you could really use games to kind of open up a lot of windows into whatever the topic was. So I was very interested in that. And fortunately, my administrators were equally enthusiastic about me trying to bring things like that in. So that was awesome. As far as the industry goes, I really got involved with a few publishers early on and was fortunate enough to work with some great designers and trying to just kind of play test or develop games, and really enjoyed that. A lot of times I thought to myself, I'd love to make a game, and I have toyed around with making a game. And I got one about maybe half to three quarters of the way done. But most of the time, I always thought, you know, I'm just not that great at kind of coming up with it out of whole cloth. But I've played so many games, I can usually help when it comes to trying to tweak something or refine something or give suggestions. So for your listeners out there, I did a little bit of work on Flashpoint Fire Rescue. Our playtest group suggested the idea of being able to swap out your roles, which became part of the game. Mm-hmm. If you've ever played Flashpoint, the roles are awesome, but if you're the CAFS firefighter, sometimes you're just useless and you really need to be something else. So we were like, Kevin, is there a way that we could have players be able to go and swap out roles? And he said, sure, you know, go back to the fire truck and you can change your role. And that became part of the game, which we were really happy about and grateful that, the designer took that input and said, yeah, that doesn't sound like a bad idea. And so I learned a lot about design from the designers that we worked with. You know, you can't get your ego involved, and you have to be willing to listen. And, it's your baby. It's hard. It's hard when people are giving you feedback that maybe you weren't expecting or took you from left field. But a lot of the designers that I've worked with have just been fantastic people. So that's one that I worked on. I did some work with Terraforming Mars and worked on that team. Again, great designers, great people to work with, the Frixellis family, really, not just the brothers, but the whole family. And what was the other one? I don't know. I forget. I'm getting old. But anyway, worked on some games. And so went to a lot of conventions, working for publishers, volunteering, and getting to have those experiences. And it was awesome. So that was a part of a period of my life that was just a lot of fun. And now that things are kind of slowly getting back to normal, maybe, if anything can be said to be normal in this day and age, sure. I'll just let that sit there. I kind of thought, I miss podcasting a little bit. So that's the backstory there. You asked for it and you got it. So that probably went a little long, but I'm old and I've done stuff. So there you go.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. It's always good to hear like where someone's coming from before we dive in and talk about how that influences everything you play and you enjoy.
Yeah, I think we each of us have a unique journey into tabletop gaming, and it's always interesting and surprising how or what games really brought us into the hobby, and then the effect it's had long term. And then I guess the thing that most people don't know, our friends out there who are listening, is the industry itself is very interesting and very small. Like, it looks like from the outside, like, these are huge companies, these are mega corps, and you're just like, nope, they're pretty much mom and pops. Like you mentioned Terraforming Mars, and we got to meet two of the brothers, including the designer, and he was talking about, you know, his mom plays Terraforming Mars every day, and she's like the ultimate game tester and his biggest fan, and we're just like, of course she is, because again,
that's a good mom. Mars, yeah,
yes,
yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
it's a very different industry, and it's a wonderful industry because we get to all be at the table together. You know, media people, game designers, publishers, we're all one big happy family playing a great game. So I love it. I just love it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's and it's really been inspiring to see how some stuff, how it works behind the scenes. I did a lot of work with Steven Bonacor of Stronghold Games, right?
Oh,
back before, he basically sold the company. and has kind of gone into Don retirement. But he was one dude. Like, he was literally one dude running that entire place. And the energy that that guy has is just absolutely amazing. And if you've ever met him, like, he's kind of just like this dynamo. And he's older than me.
Yeah.
And it's like, where did that come from? Like, how do you do that? And he just knew so much about the world of business and finance and was able to bring that to bear, you know. And so you have people in the industry that come from very different backgrounds.
Yes.
They bring a lot of skills with them.
Yes.
Sometimes 100%. They're artists, you know, sometimes they're business people. And it's really interesting when you see, like you said, what their journey is and,
yes.
and how they progressed. I mean, I was hanging out with Steven when he first really started and was doing basically deluxe reprints, you know, Survive. And,
sure.
What was the espionage game that had those beautiful pieces? I'm trying to remember what that one was called. It was fantastic. Deception, I think it was called, or something like that. And so there was just, you know, watching that company grow, watching Travis's company grow, Indie Boards and Cards and things like that. And, you know, just kind of really spending time with designers like Tim Fowers, great guy, you know.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
Who does all of those great games like Burgle Brothers and all that. Love those games. Or Dr. Finn, you know, Steve Finn. Mm-hmm. He's a guy. You know,
yes.
and he's put out some incredible games, like, you know, Biblios is one of my all time favorites. And, you know, he's just one of the nicest guys you'd ever want to meet. So, like you said, Chris, the small industry, it has that mom and pop feel. And unless you're Asmodee, you know, which interestingly enough now seems to be falling apart.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, all of these were just small people passionate about making board games for the rest of us. To enjoy and to love and to spend time with. And sure, you know, they made some money, but believe me, they weren't getting rich off of it.
Sure.
You know, you need to have that evergreen title to be able to make some decent money. Otherwise, it's as much a labor of love as it is anything.
Absolutely true. And again, more and more as we meet more people in the industry, we meet more of our friends and listeners out there. You just, it's a passion and love that's undeniable. And as you said before, Jeff, like, you bring it everywhere. You bring it to the classroom because you want to kind of, you know, get more people involved in gaming because it's such a wonderful and dynamic social hobby and brings so much to people's lives. Just it brings people together again. So, Jeff, you're going to have a amazing feature for us where you're going to talk about Civ games, which I know is one of Anthony's favorite mechanic area kind of things. And so stick around for that, because that's going to be hardcore, because I love talking about that stuff. But before we get into all that in our particular feature review, let's talk about the games that we want to get to the table, because, again, they're awesome, they're amazing, and they're going to blow your mind. So let's talk about our acquisition disorders. So, Anthony, what do you have up for us this week?
All right. I am a little off the beaten path this week.
Is it Arcana? It's Arcana.
It's not Lorcana.
It's got to be Lorcana. Everyone's playing Lorcana. You've got to be playing Lorcana. It's Lorcana.
The more I see about Lorcana, the less I want anything to do with Lorcana. I can't even.
Yeah.
All these pictures. Like, it released at the parks today, so I was looking at the pictures, and there's like lines that are 4 hours long at Disney World where they're preparing for a hurricane. There's people standing in line for cards. What are you doing? Good on y'all. Good on y'all. Hope
this
is
the number one Lorcana podcast, people, where we just...
Yeah.
We just marvel at the suit. I shouldn't say tsunami, because again, those people are going to get hit with water and stuff like that. But it is a crazy, insane situation. So, good. Talk about Lorcana or another game if you really want to. It's fine.
Another game. We're going to do another game.
All right, fine.
Lorcana. So this is Will's influence rubbing off on me a little bit.
Oh, I met Will. He's awesome. He also likes
Will's
Lorcana.
Mm-hmm. I don't think he does.
He doesn't. So,
this is Obojima Tales from the Tall Grass. It's an RPG. It's on Kickstarter right now, and I actually saw this at Gen Con. They were previewing it, so they had like an early copy of it, and then they had one of those little cards where, like, scan the QR code and follow us on Kickstarter. And I was like, that looks cute, I will do that. I don't play a lot of RPGs. It's a big time commitment, and with the family, young kids, and teaching and everything else, it just They often fall apart, and I feel bad about that. So I do own a lot of these books, though, because they're fun to read.
They are.
I love looking through it and just seeing all the lore behind it, and the artwork is amazing. So this one, that's what caught my attention. They call it a Studio Ghibli and Legend of Zelda-inspired campaign setting for D&D 5e. And it really does look like that. Like, the cover is like this big skeletal whale with a girl on its head. It's all very bright and blue. Looks very Miyazaki, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is on Kickstarter. It's been up there for a little while now. They're up to almost $2 million in funding.
Wow.
Like 2,000% of what they were asking for. people are all about this thing. So it is a role-playing setting. Obviously, you're on the island of Obajima, and you're exploring and encountering all these fun, quirky little things. There's 60 monsters in the book, so they've built out kind of this lore. So you have things like a rubble golem and a sheep dragon, like these little Japanese-inspired like demon-type things from like Spirited Away, Uragama, but they're also somehow kind of cute. And there's potion crafting, so it's very like, it's like a cozy RPG, right? It's like in that kind of vein of things, but combined with like that aesthetic from a Miyazaki type movie, a Ghibli movie, and a little bit of Zelda, right? Because you're doing exploration, you're uncovering different treasures and trying to explore. So I will probably back this, probably just for the book, because again, I get the books, I like to read through them, hopefully someday I get to play them. Sidebar, I recently got a book for Tales of Zadia, which is based on the Dragon Prince show that's on Netflix, that my daughter and I watch. And she saw it in my office, and she's like, oh, can we play this? And I'm like, oh, I have to read it. Literally the next day, she's like, did you read it yet? 300-page RPG manual. She's like, did you read that yet? I'm like, no, hon, it's going to be a couple weeks.
Aw.
But she's very excited. So if you're interested in this, which I encourage you to check it out, especially if you love looking at RPG books like I do, you can get just the book by itself. It comes with a PDF, $60. These things tend to cost about that much now, so it's expensive, but artwork's expensive. But it goes up from there. If you like all the other stuff, you can get player journals and art prints and an explorer's box and a potion deck and vending machine dice set and... What else they got here? A DM screen. They got stickers. They got pins. They got other dice sets. They've got handouts. It goes on and on. Like, you could spend, I think their highest package is $360. Comes with all that stuff.
Sure.
And people are backing it because it does look cool. It does look cool. So this is me. I'm not Will, so I can't tell you all why this is an interesting RPG setting, but I can tell you I love the look of it, and I like the background that they've talked about, and I will probably pick this up.
Well, it's fascinating that they were able to get this close to the IPs and still legally be able to put this out, because it is close, my friend.
Yeah, it is, but also, like, when you read through some of, like, the samples, it's all unique. Like, they're being creative, they're just, like, being within that kind of world and subset. And there's a lot of, like, Ghibli-inspired stuff out there. They don't seem to mind. Like, as long as you're not stealing their characters, they don't seem to care. So it's cool. I like that they went for it, and it seems to work. Obviously, I haven't read the full book, but flipping through it at Gen Con and looking at it here, I'm like, this looks like they pulled it off. So
that's great. All right. Well, let me talk about something, talking about kind of close to IPs, and yet somehow it's being produced. And I generally don't think or look at these games, but because it's so on the nose, I had to check it out. On Kickstarter right now is a game called Dungeon Cart. Race against your evil rivals in this fast-paced board game for two-day players featuring the villainous bosses from Boss Monster. My friends, they've made Mario Kart. It's Mario Kart.
They did.
It's Mario Kart. It's Mario Kart. They did it. The crazy people, they did it. They made Mario Kart. It's Mario Kart. Is it Mario Kart, Anthony? It's Mario Kart, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it's 100%. And, like, all the emails, because I'm on their mailing list, it's just, like, without using the word Mario, it's all, like, like, watch out for that legally distinct flying shell that may or may not be blue, because we're coming at you with Dungeon Cart.
So this game is absolutely positively a spectacular table presence, because you're doing Mario Kart. So it is a number of different hex boards, and you have translucent standees as one of the boss monsters. If you have not played Boss Monster, we played it way back in the day, and it's had multiple iterations and expansions and things like that. Primarily, you're the boss monster. You're one of these, again, legally distinct IP characters from Nintendo or Legend of Zelda, and you are trying to stop the heroes from, you know, messing you up. Well, now you get to play them as actually a Mario Kart. So it's what you expect. It's bombastic. It's out there. It's pretty much, again, it reminds me of that CMON model with like their zombies where they're like, hey, we're producing a game. We could throw this in here. So again, there's a lot of characters that you will recognize. The gameplay itself, obviously very simple, very simplistic. You get a player board that has, you know, your racing, and you'll be able to up or down your speed. Each character has special abilities, and then you are against the other players at the table. As you move around the table, and as Anthony said, you throw legally distinct turtle shells and other magic spells at players. And then again, of course, that whoever comes in first wins, because shenanigans, right? That's the game. It's on Kickstarter. I'm not backing it, but you should take a look at it because it's hilarious.
just for the lulls, right?
I think so. I think, you know, we talked about this before. You got to moon pie some things. Like, you got to go out there on a limb. And they did. And I appreciate that. And I hope to see it at a game table. I will not play it, but I will love to see that at a game table and just marvel at it's just it's out there. It's great. So check it out. You got about 10 days to go to pick it up. I think for Anthony's, you got about just over 2 days to pick it up. What about you, Jeff? Is there anything that just blew your mind here that may or may not be a legally distinct IP?
Yeah. For me, what I've been sort of waiting on with a lot of anticipation is I backed Unsettled while back, and that was actually due to be here not too long ago, but then they ran into an issue with some of the trays. And Orange Nebula does some really fantastic production work, and they just wanted everything to be just right. Their communication is always fantastic. And so there's been a little bit of a delay. So it might be another month or so, but it's coming, and it's something that I'm really looking forward to, because I've always liked the sort of adventure sort of games, you know, games like Ryan Lockett's games, like Sleeping Gods and Near and Far and things like that, and the Sherlock Holmes games, and, you know, any of those kind of narrative sort of games, other than I wasn't a big fan of Arabian Nights. Every time you did, like, what seemed to be the right thing, someone would turn you into something. I don't know.
Yes.
It was all very random and very bizarre. But I kind of fell in love with Orange Nebula with Vindication. Really enjoyed that game. And so when I saw Unsettled, I was like, oh, okay, this looks like this might be kind of what I have been looking for that sort of exploration sort of feel. Because I did back Seventh Continent.
Yes.
And Seventh Continent was an interesting game. And I enjoyed it, but it kind of became a little bit of a slog. As I was kind of exploring, you know, the island that was the Seventh Continent, and it didn't really hold my attention, but it sounds like Unsettled should. So I'm really looking forward to that. And the only other one that I kind of, I wish that I had recorded with you guys a little bit earlier, because I am a big Martin Wallace fanboy. I like a lot of Martin Wallace's games. He's been a little bit of a hot streak for me recently. I mean, I love Anno 1800. I loved Australia. You know, just some really good games. Loved Rocketman. Have no idea why that game hasn't gotten more love than it's received. But when I grew up, here we go. Here's Grandpa. Back in the day, when I was a youngin', there were a lot of adventure books. And they were kind of like choose your own adventure kind of things. And so some of them were these kind of cool fantasy adventure books. And so what they've done is they've taken some of the titles from those old Steve Jackson, Ian Livingston kind of books that were choose your own adventure kind of almost like little mini RPGs. And they've turned them into a card game. And so each deck in this game is going to be one of the books, basically. And so it's called, you know, Fighting Fantasy Adventures. It's actually on GameFound, but I think it's only got a couple days left, so I'm not sure. It might be done by the time this episode airs. But it was reasonably priced, which is hard to find nowadays. And, you know, they might be open for late pledges and things like that after the campaign's over. So, you know, you might want to go and check it out because it was really kind of an interesting project. Kind of gave me some nostalgia vibes. And, you know, Martin Wallace has been a little hit and miss with some of his card games. Old Men of the Forest, truly a terrible game. but he's also done some really, really solid games and, you know, wonderful games that I've been enjoying for many, many years. So that's one. If you're into that kind of game, it's not just a solo. It's for 1 to 4. It's cooperative. Sounds like a little dungeon crawl with cards. Looks like it's relatively light. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty interesting. And you know, a copy of the game is $35. So
wow,
that's not too bad. You know, no. So you get like 4 different kind of decks of cards, each of which is a different adventure. And I guess if it sells well, they'll probably do more books, you know, but for right now it's 4 books for $35. And that's something that I'd be willing to take a flyer on. So that's kind of what I've been thinking about, guys.
I've seen those floating around, the ads for them. Yeah, I was like, oh, that's some old school stuff. It like very Steve Jackson-y vibes. But then Martin Wallace's name on there. Like, ooh.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yep. Check that out.
Always gets my attention. Yep.
Absolutely. All right. So that's what we want to hit the table. Let's talk about the games that did hit the table this week at the table. We'll let you know if the game's a buy and you should run out and pick that game up. If that game's a play and you should sit down and play it, if that game is a dodge and you should avoid it, or in fact, that game is a dreaded burn, and let's be honest, you know, it's not Lurkana, right? Because Lurkana's the best. We all agree, Lurkana, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lurkana tattoos all around, right? That's what we're doing?
Yeah. No, it's cool, man.
Ride or die with Lurkana? That's going to be a thing, right? Because it's the best game. So, all right. So, Anthony, what have you played this week?
It's a card game.
Is it Lurkana?
No.
Ah, come on, man. Oh, so excited there for a second.
I know you were. I picked this up at Gen Con. It's called Mindbug First Contact. Chris, you played it too, actually.
So. I did. It sucked my mind out, and I don't remember it. Yeah. But okay.
That is the danger of the Mindbug.
So. That's 100% true. Brain. Yeah, and to be fair, there's no other games but Lurkana these days, so let's go.
That's true. That's the only one left. All right, so this was on, I think, Kickstarter a year or two ago, and it was the big name on it is Richard Garfield, but it's a whole design team. It's Scaff Elias, Marvin Hagen, Christian Kudal. Richard Garfield, I imagine, did some punch-up, right? Like, I don't think this is probably an original design, but I don't know. I don't have the Kickstarter open in front of me. But the Ghost Galaxy booth had copies of it alongside Keyforge, so I picked one up. Have had a chance to play. Chris, you and I played a couple times at the airport.
We did.
Which is not the greatest place to play anything, but we did play it there. And I've played it a couple times at home with the kids. And so here's the gist of the game. Very simple. You have a single deck of cards that everybody shares. You draw up 10 at the start of the game, and that's your deck. And that's it. You play the game with that. You have 2 mind bugs, and you just take turns taking actions. You can, as an action, you can play a card or you can attack. If somebody plays a card, you can play a mind bug on that card, unless there's like something blocking you from doing that, and then it becomes yours. So if you're like, I want that, now it's mine. And that's it, right? But you can only do that twice per game. Games are very, very short, like 15 minutes. Probably the best way to do this would be best 2 out of 3, because then you're looking at 30, 40 minutes. And the cards have a variety of different things on them, right? So they have, some of them have special abilities that are familiar, so like taunt or tanking ability. Some of them are poisonous, so if they attack, they're going to kill whatever they hit no matter what. Some of them can take multiple hits, but generally what they are is they each have a number on them. That's their attack power. And if you attack something, if the number is higher than that other thing, you destroy it. Easy, right? So it's all very much just like matching up numbers and checking them. The strategy to the game, the tactics to the game, comes in when do you play what you have in your hand? When do you kind of pull your opponent to use their mind bug? Like, do you have a combination of cards in there that you can push out that'll make them want to steal something that you can then counter later on? And that's, I think, the thing that you really have to wrap your brain around, is that component, is working with the mind bug, getting inside your opponent's head. Because without that, it's really just you both have 10 cards and you're playing out the biggest number and then kind of working around the keywords and abilities. And it's fun and it's fine and the kids like it, but it's not particularly challenging. But when you really start playing it, it's like a bluffing game on top of those card mechanics. It's very interesting, right? You do have to make some strategic decisions. You have to think about what's in your deck. You have to think about what your opponent might have. You don't really know because you're only pulling like a percentage of the deck into your hand. And it does some very interesting things as a result, right? So you can drop down your really big, powerful card. You throw out your Luchador, which is Frenzy and a power of 9. So it can hit twice at power 9. But then maybe you have a couple poison cards sitting in your hand as well. So you're like, I hope my opponent steals this because it's super powerful. And then I'll just kill it with one of these poison cards. Right. And so that's what the game ends up becoming. And I find that very interesting and fun. You can have bad hands and you can have bad games, but because it only takes 10 or 15 minutes, I don't think that's a killer. It's not even like Keyforge, where if you pull a bad deck, you're stuck playing it for 30 or 40 minutes. It's relatively straightforward. It's super quick. So if you have a bad hand or a bad game, it's going to be over soon. The kids typically get very frustrated with things like this, and they didn't really, because it was very straightforward. Like, you read the card, you do the thing, boom, you're done. So I'm happy to have picked it up. I don't know that it rises to the level of a buy. I think in my situation, I personally am happy to own it and will play it more. I think it needs more stuff, which I know exists because it was a Kickstarter. I just have that base set, so I might go out and hunt down some more cards that add a little more variability to the game. But it's fun. It's a solid play. I'm glad I own it. It was only like $20, so like the base set. I don't know where this is available, because I think they just got it at Gen Con. But if you see it out there, I recommend giving it a play. Because it's an interesting take on this type of game, just with that one little mechanical tweak, which is always cool to me when a game does that. They're like, what about everything you know, but this too? And you're like, oh, cool. That just changes everything. I love it. Don't have to worry about paying for cards. You just play them, and then you can just steal each other's cards. It's great. So Mindbug First Contact, surprisingly good.
Excellent. Yeah, no, I got a chance to play this with you at the airport, where we just had wrapped up Gen Con, and I think our brains were already mind bugged a little bit. So
yeah, it was not the best circumstances to play. Nah. The weather was terrible, and we had to get on a plane soon.
There's a whole bunch of stuff. We talked about that earlier, but it is a very good game for what it does. And I think the mind bug cards, each player gets 2 cards. It's an interesting idea, because when you play these, you know, quasi deck builders attack the other, you know, one-on-one player kind of thing, it is always going to be the randomness of the deck, what you get in your hand, and then you win or you lose. I mean, yes, there is a little bit of elements of, as far as like, when do I play this or I play that, but having the mind bugs is a really smart idea to kind of help manage the chaos of the deck, because there's a lot of cards, and as you mentioned, there's a lot of keywords in the game. And for example, sneaky, right? So if you have a sneaky character on your side and they don't, they can't stop you. So mind bug, right? So it looks to be this kind of very tactical card game. A lot of fun. It has a very smash up kind of look to it, I would say.
Mm. But Yeah.
But it primarily comes down to, as Anthony, you were saying, like a bluffing game, right? Those 2 mind bug cards need to be played. Could you win without them? Probably, possibly, but it's a rare day. Like, if you picked up a rare hand that just rocks, but those mind bugs is the whole game. So you're looking at your hand. What will you pull? Should you make the person discard cards? Should you put something strong down or a bunch of weak cards? Mind bugs. Look at the mind bugs, because that's the game. you know, I mind bug you, but you mind bug. Yeah, that's the game. So it gets a play for me. I think it was an interesting dynamic. I do think, like you said, Anthony, I don't want to get away from like the quickness of this game, which is what it's meant to be. But I do think it should have had at least one other element or trick to it, whether it was like a scoring opportunity on the side or some missions or goals or something like that. But otherwise, yeah, it's a fun little game.
Yeah, and maybe the other stuff has that. Again, I don't have the Kickstarter open in front of me, so I don't know what other stuff they released. But I imagine there's more coming, assuming that people like it.
Well, just mind bug them and get the stuff for yourself. That's all I'm saying.
True. Ooh,
should walk around
more cards, please.
Walk around the convention and just carry the mind bug cards with you. Be like, I like that game, mind bug. And they're like, what? No. Come on, we all recognize the rules here. I get the thing. So I got to play a game that also I got at Gen Con 2023. This was a review copy from CGE. This is The Lost Ruins of Arnak, The Missing Expedition. 2 to leaders, solo/2-player campaign, and there's a lot more to it. I am not going to review the campaign because it has spoilers in it, but I will talk generally about the campaign because I think you should know about this game. So, if you are a fan of Lost Ruins of Arnak, you're probably going to pick this up because, as I mentioned, it has 2 new leaders, and that's awesome. In addition to the 2 new leaders, it also has additional cards, additional challenges. It has 2 additional research track boards. And if you know anything about Arnak, it's all about the boards. It's all about the researching. If you have not played Lost Ruins of Arnak, primarily it's a quasi-deck builder, worker placement game, and then a race to the top to get the most points possible. There is another expansion that came out not too long ago with, you know, leaders, which gave you some more asymmetry at the table. You had a character, that character was known for doing a thing, and it had its own particular play style. It wasn't game breaking, but it did enough of a different thing that, depending on what character you played, it gave you a different feel. And I played Arnak a lot, and it does get a little samey, and I love the fact that the leader is in there. That's one of my favorite parts of any board game, that I get to play different types of characters, and it really opens up this world. It would be a very bland world if there wasn't different people entering this mythical kind of jungle. The game itself, as far as I mentioned, comes with a campaign. Not going to talk about too much. Some elements you'll see from the previous free online edition, if you wanted to play some of the expedition elements, it's all packaged here. It's a very innovative, fun engagement. I played it solo. You could also play it 2 players, which I think it might play a little bit better as 2 players, because in the 2-player mode, you have the ability to transfer over one, you know, like this carrier pigeon. You get to carry over materials back and forth, and that's kind of fun. You can talk during the game. It's not one of those like you have to stay silent, and it just adds more to the game. So maybe at a later point, if I get a chance to play as 2 players, I'll talk more about the campaign. But I will say the campaign's good. I mean, it's Euro game good. I would say it's better than Scythe Rise of Fenris good.
Ooh, okay.
Which I thought was okay. I didn't think it was great. I thought it was okay. Like when I finished Rise of Fenris, the campaign, I was like, okay, cool. I see what you did there. This is better. This is actually better than that. It's not Pandemic Legacy level at all. Do not go into this thinking you're getting some wondrous RPG kind of element, but the campaign is good. What I got to play with most is I got to play with the 2 new leaders and the different tracks. First off, the tracks itself, the research tracks, are worth the game, worth picking up the expansion alone, because they're colorful, they're bright, they're different. And if you played Arnak again, it's very much like, I need to move here and here and here. This really opens the game up. There's new sites, there's new cards, there's new things. But really what you came here for, what I came here for, was the new expedition leaders. So first up, you get a journalist. So the journalist is trying to find out what happened to this lost professor. And again, we always appreciate when board games are trying to help out academics. So we love that. And this journalist has a unique mechanic that he's trying to write stories about the different guardians that he encounters. So every time he's able to encounter and come out with a win here, he gets a newspaper token that goes to his board, and that allows him to unlock special abilities on his particular board. It's a really easy, simple, fun mechanic. It's really great. Then there's the mechanic. Mechanic is fantastic. And she's all about tinkering. So she's trying to fix up all these engines. She has this engine herself. And what I like about her is that you get to choose throughout the game two different gold widgets throughout. And you decide what you want to put into your machine. When you put these things in the machine, you get to turn it and you get to benefit from the stuff that's on the tokens. You have cards that allow you to activate the machine. Same thing with the journalist. There's cards that let you activate the newspaper articles and such. And then there's Rusty. There's a monkey that works with the mechanic. And that's a lot of fun too, because monkeys are awesome and they're just really fun to have. Beyond that, there's a lot of additional materials here. Like I said, there's a waterfall temple. There's a tree temple. This box is packed with stuff. Anthony, I know you bought this game. Got the review copy. It's a keeper. It's a buy for me. I was going to pick it up beforehand. I like Ruins of Arnak a lot. This made me love it. These are my two favorite leaders out of all of them. In particular, this is a better expansion than Expedition. I mean, the Expedition leaders. You need both because you need to play with all of the baubles and bits, but this is great.
Yeah, I've all I've done so far is play with the new leaders, but I do like them both quite a bit. Anytime you give me leaders, asymmetrical powers, whatever in a game like this, I'm going to just go through them one at a time until I've played them all. I kind of rank them in my own head. So this game, it does a really good job of giving you that asymmetry, and I really enjoy it. I'm looking forward to the campaign. Haven't had a chance to play it yet, but yeah. Great to hear everything is good.
Yeah, Min and Elwin did a great job here. The artwork is fantastic. It really is evocative of this theme. It's very thematic, and it's just more of good stuff. Again, I love that because it can, the base game can get kind of samey when you know that there's certain cards here. This really opens the game up. All right, Jeff, what about you? What did you play this week?
Well, I also had the chance to play some games that kind of were Gen Con. My daughter was actually working Gen Con and was able to mule some games for me, which is awesome.
Oh, very nice.
oh, yeah, absolutely. So she picked me up a game called Lunar Rush. That's from a very small sort of indie publisher called Dead Alive Games, designed by Stephen Skippy Brown. And the Ooh. Skippy just sells it for me. I love the Skippy because it's in quotes, right? Right. As is, it's on the box, Stephen Skippy Brown. So I love that about him. So, yeah, it's a really interesting game. It is a game where you are sort of shuttling back and forth between the moon and Earth. You're trying to build up a lunar base, which is something that is kind of current. There's talk about, you know, permanent settlements and whatnot on the moon and making some bases there. Congratulations to India for landing on the South Pole there.
Absolutely.
You know, kudos to them. That's awesome. And, you know, so it kind of caught my radar. And the thing that I really liked about it is kind of an economic game, but also sort of a tableau, maybe, if you want to think of it that way, building game. You're sort of building your lunar base and you're sort of upgrading the different parts of your lunar base. And you're trying to find and refine different kinds of lunar materials into things that are going to be of value and then shipping them back to Earth. The real sort of key to the game, the sort of thing that makes it very unique, is that these routes between Earth and the moon are divided into three different categories, which are actually sort of based in the science of the sort of paths and trajectories that rockets would take getting from Earth to the moon, depending on the payload that they're carrying. Because you always have to look at the trade-off between your weight or mass that you're trying to boost into orbit and beyond, and then the amount of fuel that you have to bring in order to do that. So the way the game does this is very clever. There's three different paths. There's the short path, there's the medium path, and there's a long path. And so if you're really looking to just bring like one or two things up that might be crucial components that you might need in order to build out a different laboratory or a different refinery on your moon base, you might try and choose the short route. Because you only need to get a couple of things. So whatever you send is going to basically arrive the same turn, which is awesome. If you want to send a little bit more, you can take the medium route, but you're going to have a little delayed gratification there. You can load things up, but it's going to take a couple of turns for you to have that actually arrive. And then finally, you can send a boatload of stuff, but it's going to take basically three turns in order to get that stuff, sent up to the moon or sent back to Earth. And so you kind of have to time it. And turn order is very important. So there's like a bid for turn order in the game, which adds a lot of tension. So there's a lot of individual, they call them gold buildings or facilities that you can build that sort of differentiate one base from another, kind of giving you a direction that you can go into. So I'm not going to say it's a buy because I've only played it twice, but it's definitely a play. I really have enjoyed my plays of it. I haven't played it enough to know whether the game is completely balanced or not, but it was really intriguing and a lot of fun. So Lunar Rush hit the table. I got my copy of a GNC, not GNC, the vitamin place, which is what everybody thinks I'm saying. It's a GNC, meaning it's an actual C, and it's the new Carl Chudik game. And I'm a big Carl Chudik fan, love innovation, love Glory to Rome. All of his games I find really fascinating in a kind of a mad scientist kind of a way. I don't know how he manages to make his games playable, but he does. And they're always interesting and always a blast. So this game is very interesting because you're basically, you have different islands in the Aegean Sea, and you are sort of colonizing those islands and trying to produce goods on those islands and then ship those goods back to your home island. And it doesn't sound very exciting, but like every Carl Chudik game, it's incredibly interactive. It's incredibly you throat punch the person next to you and take their stuff. It's just a really interesting game. So I've really enjoyed that. If you like Carl Chudik games, I'd say it's probably a buy. It's definitely a play. My only concern about the game is that I actually think it might be over a little more quickly than I would like. The timer of the game is your deck of cards. Everybody has their own deck based on their own civilization, whether it's the Spartans or the Athenians or the Phoenicians. And once somebody's draw pile has run out, and there are ways that you can kind of accelerate that yourself, and there are ways your opponents can accelerate that. Once your draw pile runs out, the game is going to be over relatively quickly after that. And so I almost wish the game could last just a little bit longer. So I haven't totally made up my mind, but if you like Carl Chudik, you like Impulse, you like all of his crazy creations, then I'd say definitely get it. Otherwise, I'd say give it a play. And then finally, I played Barcelona. This is one that my daughter picked up. And that is a very crunchy game. It's got a lot of spatial elements to it, where you're trying to sort of build up the new quarter of Barcelona. And you're trying to basically build housing for the people who live in the city. And so you have sort of your workers, and you have your nobles, and you have your middle class, and you're trying to kind of build up the blocks and the streets of the city of Barcelona. You're trying to kind of gain renown. You're trying to build special buildings in the squares, and you have a little trolley that you run around and drop passenger off for no reason that I can see, but it's cool. It's definitely a Eurofest kind of a game. If you like a heavy, puzzly kind of a game, then it is definitely a play. For me, it's not a buy. And it's not a buy only because I'm just a little, there's a little bit of a disconnect between the theme and the gameplay. The gameplay is super abstracted. And the way the scoring works is very interesting. Don't get me wrong, but it's kind of like, when this track of this type of citizen fills up, it's going to trigger the scoring, and here's the random scoring tile that might have nothing to do with the citizens. It might have to do with how many bonus tiles you've accumulated, or how many of the sort of broad boulevard areas you've built up in, or whatever it happens to be. And so it's very Eurolicious, but I don't necessarily know that I would call it thematic. But you know, hey, I like Stefan Feld games, and they're often not very thematic either. So
yes.
Definitely a play. But I don't know that I would necessarily say this is a buy, especially if you're looking for something that kind of captures that historical kind of feel like London does, you know. Right. London kind of takes you through the different sort of eras, and you see the progression of rebuilding the city of London with you know, exact landmarks and dealing with, you know, the poor population and the paupers and, you know, trying to figure out how to handle your poverty that's growing in the city and all this kind of stuff. That's a much more kind of thematic experience to my mind than Barcelona is, but it's a solid game.
Excellent. All right, so that's all the games that hit the table this week. Now on to our feature review. So for our feature review this week, we have brought Jeff, our good friend here, to talk about one of his favorite genre of board games, Civilization games, and in particular, one really great game that he wants to let you know about. Jeff, why don't you take it away?
Sure. Yeah, I've been a fan of Civilization games really ever since I started playing. I mean, even that first Catan card game has a bit of a mini sort of a Civilization feel as you're building up these little villages into towns and with aqueducts and different buildings and whatnot. I like the feeling of progression. I like the story that's told as you watch things build. So I've always been really interested in Civilization games because to me they feel very satisfying. I'm generally more into building than I am destroying. It doesn't mean that I won't, you know, just quietly just like and, you know, slip a knife in if I need to in a game. You know, just put me in and go to sleep. It's okay. Go to sleep. But for the most part, I'm not really into dice chuckers where, you know, you spend a lot of time building up your sort of armies and forces, and then you have the big battle, and then whoever happens to win the battle wins the game. I mean, that's not necessarily the kind of story that I really enjoy, and I like seeing the progression. I like there being different paths. And so over the years, I've played a lot of different Civilization games. If it's a Civilization game, I'm almost sure to have backed it, bought it, tried it, whatever it happens to be. And, you know, people need to understand that what I call a Civilization game might not be what you call a Civilization game. And that's totally fine. We all have different sort of opinions. Like, for example, there's a great old game by, what is it? I think it's a Bernd Eisenstein or Eisenstein, Peloponnese. You know, that's a really cool game. I don't know that I'd necessarily call it a Civilization game. It has some of the aspects. You have growth, you have disasters, you have things that you're, but it's not quite giving you that narrative, that story. People talk about Seven Wonders. It's listed as a Civilization game. I don't necessarily consider it a Civilization game. If you do, awesome. Not necessarily something that I would consider. It's a little too abstracted. Same thing with games that are Civ-ish, but have a short sort of a window that you're kind of looking through, like Age of Empires 3. Nowadays, that's called the, what is it, Age of Discovery, Glendrover's Age of Discovery. Yeah. Fantastic game. And it has interesting pieces and bits to it with, you know, you're building up your infrastructure, you're going out, you're exploring, you're exploiting. It's got that sort of 4X kind of a thing there, doing terrible things to the native peoples of the lands. So like, I get that. It's got that little peak, that little window, but I don't necessarily get the feeling that I'm building a civilization from the ground up. So for me, a Civ game needs to kind of have that feel. So, you know, I would say everything for me started with Civilization, the oldie, but the goodie from 1980. And that was primarily because of that archaeological succession chart, right? Which is this very dry kind of thing where it's like you're trying to sort of get the prerequisites you need to advance. And then when you advance, it's going to give you a benefit. And the other thing about Civilization, the original game that really got me was the trading. It was very freewheeling, you know, and it really kind of gave you that feeling of expanding, going to different parts of the world, trading, trying to collect different trade goods, trying to Selectively use your military. If you attack too much, you're going to leave yourself so weakened that you're going to get taken over. It just had a really great sort of narrative arc to it, which I really loved, especially Advanced Civilization. Then I kind of think about games like TI3, right? So Twilight Imperium 3 came out 2005. So we're jumping way ahead, all right? And I'm sure there's other games in there, like Vinci's in there, other games like that. I don't know that I necessarily call them civilization games. Age of Renaissance is in there, but I never played that. TI3, really an interesting game set in space. But you do have that sort of idea of building, and there is a progression and a narrative arc. Now, it often ends in a big conflict, which I'm not super fond of. But man, one of the things to me that makes TI3, and from what I understand, Twilight Imperium 4 shine is that politics phase. That the whole notion of, you know, vote casting and what sort of laws and what sort of things are going to go into effect that we all have to deal with. Absolutely love that, because it's not just about the projection of power from a military standpoint, but there's political power and there's intrigue. And I love that in a civilization game. Then everything changed. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
No, of course. I just wanted to jump in, 'cause like, I was wondering if you were going to mention Twilight Imperium, because to me, that is one of the best Civ games. And that is one of the reasons why I would say so, is that it has all four X's. Combat's important, but it isn't the core of the game, which I feel like a lot of the space 4XE games end up being, where they're like, oh, you just got to fight each other and shoot a lot. You do it when you need to do it to achieve your objective. Otherwise, you are working with other people or against other people. And in that sense, and it really does feel like you're part of that galactic civilization. So, yeah, I'm 100% with you on that one.
Yeah, it's definitely, and it's one of those games, it's a real experience, right? It's something that you come away with a story. And to me, that's like a hallmark of a really good civilization game. Everything changed in 2006, right? That's when Through the Ages came out. And this was the civilization game without a map, which just blew everybody's mind, I know, at the time.
Right.
It's a brilliant design. I kind of call it micromanage your civilization. It has a very broad kind of a feel to it, but it's all about the nitty gritty details of, you know, do I have enough iron? Do I have enough food? You know, what's my population? Are they happy? Love that. Love the idea that, like, you need to keep your population content and happy. Really enjoyed the fact that there was corruption, right? It's an incredible pain in the butt to deal with, but the concept of corruption, fantastic, right? So many innovative things in there. You can have conflict and wars and things without actually having to have a map on the board. There's that progression through all the different ages, hence the name of the game. Really just a fantastic game. So that was one that really, that was actually the first game I ever traded for. Was Through the Ages on Board Game Geek. So fast forward to 2009, Martin Wallace puts out Rise of Empires. Bit of an underrated Civ game, in my opinion. It's abstract for sure, but you do have a definite feeling of progression with technology in particular. This was another game that I thought did technology very well, just like Through the Ages did, right? Everything in Through the Ages is about upgrading your facilities, upgrading things, right? And Rise of Empires did that very well in a very short playtime, which I really appreciated. Then we had Sid Meier's Civilization come out with the little square cards and the combat system, which was very different and unique. And that one was a pretty interesting game as well. But to me, there were a few things that just kind of took me out of the story. The idea of, like, you know, Lincoln against, an ancient leader with kind of whatever nation or sort of leadership that you were trying to do in that version of the game. I recall that. I recall it being a little more combat heavy than I really wanted. And the combat card system was kind of wonky, but it had the exploration. Loved the exploration, loved going and sort of exploring the map. So that was like a near hit for me. But then comes the one that really just solidified for me, and that's Clash of Cultures. So Clash of Cultures, especially with the expansion, which you can now get in the Monumental Edition for a pretty reasonable price nowadays. Back when it first came out, I'm like, that's preposterous. You want me to pay $99 for a game? I'll never do that. Yeah, that all changed. That game just to me had like so many of the things that just checked off the boxes for me. The technology tree is a thing of beauty in that game. It is very difficult to wrangle because there's a lot for you to have to remember. So there's a little bit of that micromanaging thing going on with the tech tree, but the way in which you can customize that, the different paths that you can explore with that are just delicious, right? You have the exploration part, which I love. You have barbarians with an AI system that works extremely well, really easy to manage. You have differentiated military units. You have differentiated city components, where each thing that you build in a city gives you a different benefit or an ability or something of that nature. And the rules that Christian wrote for that game and the systems he came up with are, in my opinion, just a thing of beauty. The idea of the size of a city is the range of the city. The number of cities is equal to the max size of each of those cities. So if I have three little cities on the board, each of those cities can have a total of three parts or pieces to them. Just fantastic, kind of easy to remember, at least for me, rules that made it very thematic, right? You couldn't have this big, huge, massive city and all these little settlements scattered around the board. That's not really the way things worked. It's sort of the rising tide lifts all boats kind of a thing, right? And so you had exploration, you had events that would happen, you had objectives to give you a little bit of a sense of an overall strategic plan or objective. It just kind of, you had wonders that you could build. It had just about everything. And in the new edition, there's a lot of negotiation. You can trade stuff. So that harkens back to Civilization, where, you know, you could pretty much trade anything you wanted to. You know, I got this great objective card that'll really work well for you. And you can lie. Okay. You know, people will remember that, but it reminds me of Civilization. You would say to somebody, you know, I got this great card, and it's actually, you know, a disaster card that you passed off to somebody. So really clicked just about every single box. I wish it had a little bit of that politics kind of phase to it. That might be the only thing that I kind of miss, but other than that, definitely an amazing game. Now you can contrast that with Nations, which came out later. And Nations to me was like an entirely disconnected experience. Like if I'm playing Rome, but I'm building Stonehenge, I have a problem with that. The way in which that game progressed, it had a lot of like tracks, you know, there's a lot of things that you were kind of trying to progress on that were abstractions of things that were going on. You had the limited space on your board. You couldn't build this sprawling kind of civilization. You had to keep swapping out cards and things. And I'm like, why would people do that? You know, I understand that some things are lost to time, but, you know, seriously, like I would have kept this technology. I would have kept this building. So there were some odd restrictions in the game. And that kind of broke that for me. So I left that very disappointed. Then the Golden Ages came out in 2014, which was a really interesting Eurified Civ game because it had the tech tree, it had the exploration, it had some basic sort of combat-ish kind of stuff, but it was very streamlined, very Eurified, and it was a decent game, but it became a really good game with the Cults and I think it's called Cults and Cultures expansion. And that is still a game that I really enjoy playing when I don't have the time to play a big Civilization game. So that one was kind of a hit for me. Tapestry came along. I love Tapestry. I enjoy playing it. I don't know that I necessarily feel like it's a Civ game. There's going to be people who are going to really be upset about that. And if you feel it's a Civ game, awesome. I would put it in that sort of Age of Discovery, Seven Wonders, Peloponnese. Like, it's a really cool game, and you do get to build up your little town, your map in front of you. But the progressions, like, how can I be a civilization that has discovered space flight and yet I'm still way, way back in these other areas? And it can feel a little disconnected from, or not disconnected, it can feel a little improbable, right? Like, you're trying to think about your civilization and you're like, yeah, how did that happen? It's like, you're trying
it's
to
so kind of, abstracted.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I feel like you're describing the review we gave the game. We're just like, it's not a Civ game. I don't know. It's like a 2.5X-ish.
Yeah. It's a really cool game. Don't get me wrong. I have it in my collection. Yeah. I enjoy playing it. My daughter loves it. But I don't know that it really feels like a Civ. So I was a little disappointed in that. And then came Mosaic. So Mosaic comes out in 2022. And boy, it is a very, very good game. Because it just has a lot of freedom, a low rules overhead, a lot of choices. You're definitely kind of focusing on icon collection, and that can be sort of maybe a downside. I worked on and adore Terraforming Mars, which is tagged. So you kind of have that same sort of feel. But the technology cards are all different. They have wonderful artwork. It kind of builds. You get that feeling of your civilization growing, and then you have the map presence. And I love some of the rules surrounding that. I thought they were very intuitive and very interesting. You know, you can build a city, and then you can have these little towns that surround your city. But you can't just plop towns all over the place. Like, they need to be connected to something, to an urban center. It's like, okay, that makes sense to me, right? The fact that you can sort of build cities in different regions of the world is like these outposts. It's like, okay, that's cool. I like that. You don't have to daisy chain everything together. That offers a lot of freedom, a lot of opportunity. You do have a little bit of disconnect when you have the Egyptians making, you know, the Roman Colosseum or, you know, whatever. But it works for me. The only thing about that game that didn't work was the military, because the military was simply area control. That was it.
Yeah.
Not really all that interesting. Beautiful production, beautiful pieces, but it's like, okay, they're just kind of sitting there and they add a point of influence, you know, whoop-de-doo. The expansion came out and it's still kind of whoop-de-doo. But what they offer are what are called war tiles. And so if you take a military action, which is one of the things that you can do in Mosaic, and you decide to engage in a conflict, if you take a war tile, it has almost like a little prescription on it, right? A little recipe. And if you can fill that recipe, then it's going to have an effect. So you're going to get to remove more units. You might get to swap out a city of one player for one of your cities. They all have very interesting names. Some of them are sort of naval combat centered. Some of them are land combat centered. There's an amphibious landing one. There's all kinds of interesting little war tiles. I'd say there's probably about 8 or 10 of them. If I had to guess, I don't have that number, sorry to say, but that added something that I felt was cool. The naval units added something. The new wonders were cool. But most importantly, the new types of buildings were what I thought was the best value added to the expansion. So it's a really solid game. I really enjoy it. But it has not dethroned Clash of Cultures for me. And that's because I think every element of Clash of Cultures has been sort of fully described and developed. And you don't have any holes like you do with some of the other designs that I've been talking about. And I think one of the greatest things that I can say about Clash of Cultures, what hooked me on that game instantly, I'd be curious what you guys would have to say about this, was, like I told you, I don't love games that always come down to the big fight. Clash of Cultures, you have objectives that can score you a lot of points. Those objectives might have nothing to do with combat, which is awesome. But what really got me was cultural influence. The idea that my city and my civilization is so awesome that you want to be like me, right?
Yeah.
So there's a mechanism in Clash of Cultures where you can take an action where you attempt to culturally influence a city of an opponent.
Yeah,
and
soft power.
The opponent, it's absolutely, it's like, hey, I've got blue jeans and rock and roll. What do you think of that, right?
Yeah.
Let's go to Rush. I have blue jeans and rock and roll. And so like, yeah, you would like, you attempt to culturally influence another city. And if you do, you get to replace one of their pieces, that are surrounding their cities, like a fort or an academy or whatever it happens to be, with one of yours. Now, the person that had that happen to them, they don't lose the benefit that they get from having that building in the city. But at the end of the game, that building now scores you points. It doesn't score them points. And so I've played this game with people who just went all in for cultural influence, and they ended up scoring so many points on the board and then other objectives that they didn't really mess around too much with military. And I loved that about the game. I love that. That was the first time I've ever seen a game try to give you a sort of nonviolent way to win.
Sure.
So many civilization games, you know, it's all about conquest. It's all about exploration, exploitation, extermination, all of this kind of stuff. And this was just like, no, man, you just want to be like me because I'm awesome. And you just spread your cultural hegemony across the globe. And again, beautiful, beautiful design. How far can your city influence? Equal to the number of pieces in that city. Like, what a just a like a brilliant idea. So a little city doesn't have a lot of influence. Big city, it casts its shadow far and wide. And others see it, they see the success, and they're like, man, we should be like those dudes. And then sure enough, you've culturally influenced them. And it's just, it's a wonderful, wonderful system in that game. And it's one of the things that made it kind of like solidified as my favorite civilization game. So when I think about sort of the journey that I've taken with Civ games, and when I look at the design sort of things that have happened in Civ games, I can really trace a lot of ideas back to all of these different games. And yet I think Clash of Cultures right now for me still represents the best. You need the expansion because yes, that gives you that asymmetry that everybody loves, and the asymmetry is
absolutely
awesome.
Yes,
but boy, you have that. I just don't know that the game can be beat in terms of a civilization game. So that's kind of, you know, my sort of interpretation of the civilization genre. I've thrown a lot of games at you there, giving you a little bit of a history rundown in order. You know, like what's your favorite civilization game, Chris?
That's really hard because I think, Jeff, as you said it, I quite well, there are so many elements to a Civ game. And I think there's general discussion amongst players, gamers, publishers, designers, what makes a Civ game, right? As you said, having played Mosaic recently, it's like, okay, there's a board, right? Do you need to have a map? Do you need to have civilizations there? Do they need to be grounded historically? Is how abstract is the civilization game? And at some point, does it take away from the actual game itself? Does it need to have military? Is that an absolute requirement? Is card play enough? If you play, you know, through the ages, typically one of the best kind of Civ games out there, but there's no board. So you never really get the feel of, I have grown, my civilization has grown and stretched and built these things. And yet the card play is out of this world. Like there's nothing like that card play as far as like the crunchiness of building up a civilization. And I think that the point was well said too. we generally think of Civilization as our earlier civilizations and not necessarily like Twilight Imperium, right? Because that's a Civ game too. Or you could even argue Gaia Project, because you're building out the civilization, or terraforming Mars, you know, or Terra Mystica. I mean, there's so many different games for there. I own a lot of Civ games, and I think the greatness of Civ games is you can almost like, I want to play a Civ game. Cool. What ingredients do you want to have? How much military? Do you want to have soft power? Do you want to have economic? How abstract do you want it to be? Antiquity is one of my favorite games. That's a crunchy Civ game. And most people don't think of it as such because they're still buried under all the pieces. But you have to take care of your people. And then your people die. And you need places for them.
And then the cemetery overwhelms your city and you lose because there's too many graves. I've never seen a game where you lose because there's literally no more space to bury your people. Like, that's a statement right there. Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, it's probably the greatest mechanic game type in board gaming. Because you can, it's like, you know, ice cream. They're all ice cream, but they're all different flavors of a thing. If I want to play something fun, maybe Mare Nostrum Empires, because it does have that map and civilization thing. It does have trading, because even though you're fighting, you still need to trade. Through the ages, as we said before, underwater cities, because it's a thing. And then again, like you said, what elements really work well for you? And again, it depends on that time. I guess if I had to pick, if someone said to me, give me the most Civ game of Civ games, I would probably pick Antiquity. Just because I think it's the most real. Like, you produce garbage and it becomes toxic to the land. And like, that's a winning strategy. Like, I'm a jerk. I'm building up the civilization. Hope you can deal with it, because, and again,
I'm going to build all this great stuff out of wood. And then, wait a minute. There's no trees left. You know?
Exactly.
Like, you've just completely destroyed your own land. Right. Yep. Yeah.
And we see that nowadays. I mean, there's some countries actually having conversations about, you know, the water supply, right? Water has become, so do you build a dam, right? The land is eaten up. So Antiquity doesn't have military, but it does have, I'm going to crowd you out. I'm going to be aggressive in that kind of way. So that's probably mine. How about you, Anthony?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was funny. You're like, Nations didn't work for me. I think Nations is one of my favorites, but I'm such a mechanically focused guy. I like the puzzle of like the swapping the cards in and out, and the asymmetry of the different factions that you can play as. Some of the other ones, though, that I found interesting, Mosaic really clicked for me playing that recently as a new one. I was on the fence a couple times because I came to the game late of like going in and getting all the big stuff or picking up the expansion. I think I need to play it more. But I really did enjoy how the game simplified without dumbing down like the core mechanics that we get in these games. That's one of the big challenges I have with a Civ game, is it is a lot, right? So if you bring new people to them, there's a bit of a learning curve. There's a lot of teaching to be done, and you need people who are going to buy into that. It's a little difficult.
Yeah, like Clash, for example, you know, that's a big teach. That's a heavy lift, right? Because not only do you have all of these sort of systems, and no matter how well designed they are, it's still a lot of rules overhead. You know, you think about like the happiness of your city. Great little system there. You know, if your cities are happy, they're more productive. That makes sense thematically. But if you ask them to work too much, they start to grow unhappy, and they can eventually just get really angry with you. It's beautifully done thematically, but it's more rules overhead. So I get where you're going with that. Whereas Mosaic, it's like, hey, are you going to pick a card from here, from here, or from here? And it really streamlines and simplifies it for you. Yeah.
Yeah. And I appreciate that, because then I get to play it more. So, like Clash of Cultures is a game that I had the original version. I played it once. So I was like, this is fine. And then someone said, you need the expansion. And then I found out that cost $300. And so I've never actually played the game properly. I have the Monumental Edition, because when they announced that, I'm like, oh, yeah, this seems like a game I'm going to love. And I've gone through the rules, and it's just not something I'm able to get people together to play yet. So I feel like that game could be it. Everything about it seems like it would be it. Like all these big sprawling Civ games that have come across my desk, you know, that Sid Meier's Civilization, 100% agree with everything you said there. I loved everything about the idea behind it, but then the different paths to victory weren't equal unless you threw in all the expansion stuff and tweaked it a bunch, which that's not fun. So yeah, this is one of my favorite genres. The video game that really got me into games in general was Civ 2, like back in like 93 or whenever that came out. So I've been playing this type of stuff since I was like 8 years old. Sure. And if any board game that can get close to reproducing that feeling is amazing.
Right. Right. So can you, do you mind me asking you, like, what is it about Nations? So like Nations did not work for me. What works for you with Nations? Like you said that, you know, you got a little bit more of a Euro kind of a feel to it. Like what is it about Nations that is something that really clicked with you? I'm just curious because it didn't click with me.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it does simplify things quite a bit, right? Your turns are fairly straightforward, right? You're buying cards from the tableau or deploying workers. That's pretty much it, right? With some special card actions or building your wonder kind of off to the side. I actually always kind of liked the playing out of time element of it. I always thought it was fun when I was playing like Civ 3 or Civ 4. And, you know, like, I'm going to build the pyramids, but I'm Brazil, and that's funny to me. So that doesn't bother me so much. It doesn't have a huge combat component. So you really can just focus on building a tableau of cards that work for your particular situation and then optimizing them as you move forward in the different eras. So I liked that you had so many cards for each era, like just hundreds of cards, and basically we'll never see the same combination.
Optimization. Yeah. Optimization and input randomness, right? So that actually, yeah, I get that. Like you said that and I'm like, oh yeah, this is definitely more of an optimization puzzle kind of a game.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, okay, all right, yeah, I get that. That's something that I can totally see why that would be something that would draw players to it, right? Because so many games that we play and love have a lot to do with optimization, and it can lead to AP, which is one of the things about Nations. Even though the turn structure was very simple, like you said, anytime I played that game at like a full player count, oh my God, it never ended. Like it was so, and it's that optimization, right? And I never really thought of it that way, but I think you're 100% right. So it's a really cool puzzle. The swapping out of the cards, you know, what's going to be optimal, what's going to be the best thing for me to do. But yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Cause I was just curious because that one just was like a whiff for me, but a lot of people like it. So it's me, you know what I mean? It's definitely me and not the game.
Yeah. I don't think it's you necessarily. I think it's just that kind of game. Like it's not really as concerned with being thematic as it is with creating a system. And I would never in a million years play this with five people or four.
It's really rough, man. We would go to game days so, and it's like, long. We're gonna play Nations at five, and I'm like, oh God, no, not me.
That's like I did that six twice. Hours.
Yeah, I did that twice, and I was like, no, I'm never doing that again. So I agree with you there.
Yeah, if you're gonna play a 6 hour game, you might as well pull out TI4 and add on a couple hours.
Right? Yeah.
All right, everyone. So that's everything for this week. Until next time, this is Chris.
This is Anthony.
And this has been Jeff.
And we'll save you all a seat in our new and growing civilization. Until then, take care, everyone.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Thanks for having me on, guys. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming.
Absolutely.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.